different today because George and I are introducing ourselves as the new faculty here in the Robotics Institute. We are doing a cross introduction. So I'm introducing George. George introduces me. George, many of you know, has been here since 2000 after he got his PhD at the University of Maryland in College Park. George works on some very, very interesting, very neat controls, sensing, manipulation problems, and also distributed sensor networks. Some of them that George is going to talk about today. It's, for me, it's particularly interesting and important that George, as well as myself, are people who work in the control systems area, and we are, I'm sure we are both honored to be here with you today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Marcel. So, I know most of you, this is technically my introduction to you, so if I know you already, pretend like you don't know me. It's a short talk today. I mostly want to, I have this idea, this vision I'm going to use to guide the research program I'm starting to build here, is to build cheap, reliable, useful robots. And I have this idea for how to do that. And I mostly want to convey that philosophy to you. So I want to let you know what I mean, why I think it's believable that you can do all these three things at once, and tell you a little bit about some of the projects I've worked on in the past 6 years leading up to this, and the bits and pieces I've pulled out of each one of those projects to lead me this idea, and then give you a few ideas of what I think I'm going to be doing in the future. My main goal, like I said, is to convey to you my philosophy and what I'm interested in working on. I'm building this program, so I really want to talk to everyone here about what you're doing and look for partners for collaboration and things like that. So mostly this is a hello, I'm George. My office is literally right on the other side of that wall. Come talk to me anytime. Okay, so let's get started. So the basic idea, I want to build robots that are cheap, reliable, and useful. I have this this contractor who comes to my house and fixes things for me sometimes, and he always says, fast, good, cheap. Pick two out of those three, right? So you can't ever have all three. So this is a similar kind of thing here. I'm going for cheap, reliable, useful. What makes me think I can get all three? Well, I'm not sure. But if I start off with looking at simple robots, robots with small numbers of moving parts, I think you can believe that that will get me cheap and reliable. Okay. It doesn't necessarily give you useful, but it gives you cheap and reliable. So now how do you get useful? So I think the next thing to do is have these simple robots have some sort of interesting dynamics that you can exploit and use to do useful things. Okay. And then at the same time, come up with some perception algorithms, some estimation algorithms that allow you to gather the information you need to use to do these useful things with cheap and reasonable sensing. So I think if you put all three of these things together, we can build cheap, reliable, useful robots. All right. So this top thing is a design problem. You have to figure out how to build a robot that's cheap and reliable. Second thing is a control problem. So the downside of interesting dynamics is your life gets a little bit more complicated because you have to actually pay attention to the dynamics in order to make them do what you want them to. Okay. And then the third thing, the SLAM, I don't really mean SLAM, I mean estimation in a more general sense, right? How do you take information from possibly cheap sensors and get the information, you get that, distill that into the pieces of information that you want to accomplish your task, and this is estimation. So my main things are control and estimation. Those are the things I know about now. Those are the skills that I've built up over the past 6 years. I don't know a lot about design. This is an area that I want to pursue a little bit. Okay, so let's start looking at some of the projects I did on my way here. And this was an important one for a number of reasons. I worked on Rex. Most of you have seen Rex. Rex is this shoebox-sized robot with 6 legs, 1 degree of freedom for each leg, and the legs recirculate, and the legs are flexible. So this thing, you've all seen videos of it. It goes in and it just flails its arm around and it thrashes and it climbs over and it does these things that you'd never expect it to be able to do. So Al Rizzi and I did some controls work. We looked at sort of the non-holonomic planning problem to do closed loop feedback control with a camera. So we had this visual target that would give you range and bearing to the target. The problem with this target was you had to be a certain distance away from it, and you had to be, you couldn't be further than a certain distance, so you had bounds on how far away from the target you could be, and then you're looking at it with a camera so you had a field of view. So we made this control law that provably drove you to whatever kind of parking position you wanted to do. And we did a lot of fancy math that I'm not going to go into here. But the important thing about this control law is it really is a single feedback control law that's doing all these things. It's a hybrid control law that's made up of a bunch of different behaviors, but we didn't hard code in this parallel parking maneuver. We added these behaviors, we gave each behavior a sub-goal, and then we strung them all together, and this is the behavior that came out. So here we go into high-speed mode so you can see Rex actually doing the rest of that motion. Okay, so what are the nuggets that came out of my experience with Rex? Well, the first one is the simple design. You know, Rex, the first time you look at it, it's really unimpressive. You don't get impressed until you see it do the kinds of things that it can do. And to me, that was just really amazing that you could take this simple design and do really interesting things with it. Now, in order to exploit that simple design, there was some really fancy control done. Okay, I'm not talking about what I just showed you here. That's kind of a nice little result. But the actual finding the gates that made it run and made it run really fast. And if you've ever seen it in its turbo mode, it goes really fast and bounds over rocks and all kinds of things. And there was a lot of work that went into finding those gates. Okay, so the things I learned from Rex is, you know, simplicity is good. But you got to do a little bit of controls work in order to make it so that it's both simple and useful. So here's another project that has sort of simmered in the back burner for me for the past 5 years or so. And that's this project in sensor networks. So we got this grant from the USDA to instrument nurseries where they grow the kinds of bushes and plants like you would go buy at Home Depot and plant in your yard. And the approach we took was to use wireless sensor networks. So we built this system of, in this case, there were 30 nodes. So these boxes that are about yay big, they're self-contained, they have battery powered, they have a little microprocessor board, they have a radio inside. You put them out in the field, they all talk to each other and form a network. They have pretty generic interfaces so they can interface to a large set of different kinds of sensors that people who grow bushes care about. And so you put these things out in the field, they find a network, they find each other, form a network, take whatever information that they gather, relay it back to someone sitting at a desk in a farm somewhere. And then one thing we did that's a little bit different from most other sensor network research is we had actuation as well. So we could also have these nodes drive a relay to turn on a fan or turn on a sprinkler. Okay. And just, I mean, I think this is probably pretty obvious to all of you, but the way the data flowed, we had this collection of nodes out in the field. They would sort of find each other, route all the data back to a central base station, and that would get sent over the internet, and you could look at it from anywhere on the web. And we actually spent a lot of time developing this GUI. It turns out that the problem of presenting data to someone that varies in both time and space and also has different types of sensors is a very challenging problem. It's one we didn't even come close to solving. All I did was realize that it was hard. And if we pursue this further, we'll probably be looking for someone who can help us actually solve it. OK, so what did I learn from sensor networks? So the first thing is that these nodes are really very simple little computers. They have microprocessors on them for their computing. This is my first real exposure to microprocessors, like actually programming them and using them. But even though you have these simple, cheap computers, you can actually do some interesting things. The other thing, and this is a big one, is is I think that sensor networks, and in particular sensor actuator networks, are an easy, cheap, incremental way of building an intelligent infrastructure. Right? So if you want to have autonomous robots, you know, on one end of the spectrum, you can just build one robot that's super smart and is like a person and can get around and do everything it wants to do. And on the other end of the spectrum, you don't have a robot at all. You just have everything, you know, your coffee maker automatically makes coffee when you walk in the room, and the whole world just does what you want it to do. This is sort of like on the Star Trek ship, right? The Enterprise is a super smart thing. But there's a sort of a happy medium where you have a robot, but the environment around it sort of helps it out. And this is not a novel idea. People have been thinking about this for a long time. But I think these sensor networks, you know, these nodes we built, they cost like $100 each. And they give you this nice way to put in a distributed infrastructure. Installing the infrastructure is as simple as just setting boxes down in a few places. And this can help you. It gives you a communication infrastructure for your robot. It gives you a way of giving them local information about what the environment's like around them. And it can be used, as I'll get to in a future slide, it can also be used as a localization infrastructure. So you can use it to help the robot estimate its position. Okay, here are a couple other projects that I worked on. I talked about both of these in my interview talk, so I'll go over them very quickly. The first is DepthX, which is this underwater cave exploring robot. We took it in May down to Mexico, put it in this 1,000-foot deep cave, and it explored it and built a map. Here's a movie of one of the runs. So the vehicle doesn't even really show up. It's sort of a little tiny dot at the middle of all these beams. And as the vehicle swims down, it's using this coarse array of sonar beams to build a map of the walls of this cavern as it goes to the bottom. And oh, too bad we didn't get to see the... Basically, this little outline is what the cavern looked like. You know, one of the key contributions, I think, was that we were able to do SLAM with these incredibly coarse and noisy sensors. If you look in the SLAM literature, a lot of it uses laser range scanners, stereo vision, or omnivision. We had 56 range sensors pointing in all different directions. Not only that, they had pretty wide beam widths, so it was pretty coarse spatially, and the accuracy wasn't all that good. The second project is BallBot, which is a robot that's about human size. Intentionally, it was designed to be about human size. It's yay big around, maybe 5 feet high. It's a cylinder, and it balances on a single point of contact with the ground. So it balances on this sphere down here. And the idea of this thing is that it's human size, yet we put all the weight up at the top, so high center of gravity, skinny human-sized robot is sort of the polar opposite of your typical mobile robot, which on a typical mobile robot, you put as much of the mass down low, so you get a low center of gravity. And these things typically have to be pretty wide, especially if you're going to make them tall so they don't tip over. So, of course, the downside of balancing on a point and making your robot skinny and putting all the mass at the top is that you've actively got to balance the thing in order to make it work. Okay, so what are the little nuggets I got out of these things? So underwater robots, well, first of all, I mean, I always thought underwater robots were cool, but I never realized how simple an underwater vehicle is. So the DepthX vehicle was a 3,000-pound, multi-million-dollar vehicle, but when you boiled it down to what it actually was, it was really a rigid body with a bunch of thrusters attached. Okay. And it doesn't get a lot simpler than that. So I hadn't thought of underwater robots as being simple vehicles before, but now I do. The other thing that I guess I sort of knew but was really driven home is that underwater sensing is just a whole different ballgame than sensing above ground. And I don't know, it's probably partially because of the physics just makes it harder, but also because there hasn't been as much development. When you sense above ground, you have laser range scanners, you have cameras. When you sense underwater, you have sonar is really the only good sensing methodology. And there are sonars that approach the performance of really, really crappy webcams, but they cost like $250,000. So the challenge of estimation in the underwater domain is even more important because you're dealing with more constrained sensors. Okay. The bigger picture on BallBot is that, again, BallBot's a simple robot. It has a really small number of moving parts. You know, it's got a couple rollers, the ball, and the body. And we've seen it do some pretty, depending on the day, impressive or scary things. We haven't quite solved the problems yet. There's still some open problems on BallBot, but it can really whip around. It can really move pretty well. And I'm convinced that the power of BallBot comes from the fact that it's a balancing robot. And then the last thing is, you know, obviously control is obviously important to make it stand up. Planning is also important because now you have to plan in the presence of these dynamic constraints. You have to plan. You can't just move from one point to another. You've got to be leaning a certain way. And if you want to turn a corner, you've got to lean into that. And so planning these dynamic trajectories to get you from one point to another is an interesting thing as well, I think. Okay, so I've done a bunch of stuff in SLAM and have addressed multiple variants of the SLAM problem. One of them is range-only SLAM. And basically, this is an experiment where we went out on the football field and we placed a bunch of radio tags at the locations where the little pluses are. And then we had a golf cart vehicle drive around. It had a gyro attached to it. And it took range measurements in it, and it positioned itself and simultaneously found the positions of the beacons and localized itself as well. Let me start this other movie. So the dual cousin of range-only SLAM is bearing-only SLAM. This is actually data from the Victoria Park data set where the range information has been stripped out. But the motivation for doing bearing-only SLAM is that you could use a simple Omnicam or even just a regular monocular camera. You get bearing information from the camera, and you can solve the SLAM problem. Okay. Let's get one more. Okay. Another place, another direction for SLAM is this notion of hybrid SLAM. So you can break the world up into a topology, and you can do sort of standard metric SLAM on the edges of your topology. So the topology breaks the world up into small submaps. You do your standard local SLAM on the submaps. You stitch them all together with the topology. And this allows you to cover large areas, but because you're independently finding these submaps and you're not keeping track of all the correlations between the submaps, you can do this in a lot more computationally feasible way. Okay, and we did this experiment where we covered 6 floors of Wien Hall and successfully were able to localize the robot in a very quick way. All right, So what did I learn from this? First, I learned that cheap SLAM is possible, right? It's not solved yet, okay? When you looked at those movies, you probably saw there's still some issues there. But I think we can do SLAM with cheap sensors. Particularly, we can do range-only SLAM with a cheap embedded infrastructure, and we can do bearing-only SLAM with webcam-like devices. Smart environment can help. What I mean by this is the nodes in my sensor network could be beacons, just like the radio tag beacons in the range-only SLAM experiment. Okay, so you could have this environment that's giving you range information and helping you localize as well. And then the final thing, and this is sort of a big question, is a globally accurate estimate of where you are important? Okay, we're sort of in this mindset because we have GPS. That you gotta know exactly where you are on the face of the planet to within so many centimeters. And that's what localization means. But if you think about many robot tasks don't really require that. Right? They require localization relative to your environment. You know, you gotta go to the Coke machine, you gotta put a dime in the slot, you gotta press the button. You don't need to know your GPS coordinates in order to do that. And if you're willing to give up globally accurate metric information about where you are, then there's a lot of power that can be saved in the SLAM algorithms with approaches like the hybrid SLAM that we have there. Okay, so that's just a little bit about what I've been up to. So now where are we going? So one of the big directions I want to go in is balancing robots. I've really had a lot of fun working with BallBot. Ballbot is an ongoing project. There are still lots of big outstanding problems we need to solve. If you have ideas about how to solve them, we'd like to hear from you. But these are the kinds of things we're looking at with Ballbot. But I think that that there's other types of balancing I would like to look into. In particular, I'd like to look into sort of simple articulated balancers. So take something like a segue kind of format. Give it 1 or 2 degrees of freedom just that are there just to sort of help it balance. And see what you can do with it. You know, here's a little ODE simulation that a student ginned up or is in the process of ginning up of a one such concept. So you basically have this sort of 4-bar linkage so the whole thing can lean side to side. You've got wheels in contact with the ground, so you've got, you sort of balance forward and backward with the wheels, you lean side to side with the linkage. You know, I think if we made these wheels out of big, fat, knobby mountain bike tires and built one of these things, I think it would do impressive things, right? So right now we're investigating that in simulation. And of course, I'm just getting started, so I don't have funding for any of this. So we're looking for routes and funding. But I think this has the potential to be really interesting. In a similar vein, our friend Sid over at Intel has bought himself a Segway platform, and he bought himself a Barrett arm, and he plans to put the two together. And now this is not cheap by any stretch of the imagination, but it's relatively easy in that you have these two off-the-shelf robots. You stick them together. You now have an articulated balancer, effectively. And then you also can study mobile manipulation. So I think that mobile manipulation, putting a manipulator on a mobile robot and having it do interesting things, is going to revive the field of manipulation in general. Because robots have gotten to the point where you can do things like this. You can buy this robot, you can buy this robot, you can stick them together. And now you've got a robot that doesn't have the workspace constraints of a manipulator, but can do interesting things unlike a mobile robot. So I am interested in coordinated control of balancing mobile manipulators, but I'm also interested in sort of kinematic control of your standard manipulator mounted on a regular statically stable wheeled robot. Okay. Another direction I want to go in is underwater robots. And you know, like I said, I had this realization on the DepthX project that underwater robots could be really simple. So I sort of embarked on this journey to discover how cheaply I can build one for and how simple I can make one. And if you look online, you'll find a lot of hobbyist websites that have put together really cheap, simple ROVs, so remotely operated underwater vehicles. And that's great, and we've borrowed a lot of ideas from those people. But it's really challenging to go from the ROV to the AUV because the sensing is so horrible and so hard to do. Okay? So we're trying to figure out how can you really make an autonomous underwater robot cheaply? What kind of sensing can you use? And the way we're starting is just by constraining ourselves to be in a pool and using cameras for sensing. Okay. So we built this little robot called ShallowX. So how cheap can we make one is a direction I want to push, and we're pushing on that with ShallowX, and we're gradually adding capabilities to it. I'm interested in exploring novel types of locomotion, or not even novel types, unusual types of locomotion. One of the nice things about underwater robots is the hydrodynamics are important, right? In air, you can stand here and flap your arms and nothing happens. But if you're in water and you flap your arms, you impart forces on yourself and move yourselves around. So I want to explore, again, keep them cheap, keep them simple, but instead of using little propellers like we have on this one here, you know, use fins and wiggle your fins around. Or make a glider that changes its buoyancy and glides up and down by driving its buoyancy. So these are some things I want to explore. Of course, I want to explore applications, partially because it's fun to apply stuff, but also because you've got to find funding, and that's where the funding comes from, is from being able to apply it. I think there are lots of applications, scientific exploration, inspection, homeland security, things like that. And then finally, and this is very important, I think that these things make great educational platforms. Students get excited about them. They're nice little safe platforms that operate in full 6DoF and have really non-trivial dynamics and really interesting sensing problems. So I think it'll be useful for that as well. Okay, one other direction I want to go in. SLAM in general, so estimation in general. I want to, you know, there's lots and lots of work in SLAM. I want to keep pushing that body of work towards the point where it's inexpensive to be applied on a robot and be used by it. Here's a little equation that describes one extreme of that. This is a little 6th degree of freedom solid state IMU from SparkFun. It costs about $300. Okay, and here's a couple ultrasound sensors. It costs like $4 or $5 each. All right. So if I made a localization out of system out of these two things, would it work at all? I don't know. Okay, but I'd like to find out. In principle, this is no different from having a nice ring laser gyro IMU and a laser range scanner, right? Except that this is way crappier and this is way crappier. So I don't know what's going to come out. But I'd like to push that. And maybe you don't get all the way to here, okay? Or maybe if you get all the way to here, you've got to make some assumptions on your environment, like it's made out of flat planes and things like that. But I'd really like to push this direction and see how we can get SLAM down to something that's really cheap and really easy for everybody to do. If you look at this as sort of a what the SLAM space is, you know, here's the exterior sensing. In the case of DepthX, we had really bad exterior sensing, but we had a nearly a perfect motion model, so we were able to do really impressive things. Okay, in the more typical SLAM scenario, you have pretty good extraceptive sensing, so you have like a laser range scanner or something like that. And your motion model is almost useless, but you can still do something there. So the question is, can we get out here? And this is the direction I'd like to push in. Okay, so that pretty much wraps up what I have to say today. You know, my main point is that I think we can build cheap, reliable, useful robots by combining simple designs with a little bit of clever control and a little bit of clever estimation. The directions I want to pursue, balancing robots, mobile manipulation, underwater robots, cheap SLAM, generally anything that involves simple robots with interesting dynamics is something I'm interested in talking about. And the bottom line is, and this is the most important one, is I'm starting up this new research program. And none of this is like funded project that I'm going to pursue. I need to like find collaborators and write proposals and things like that. So I encourage you to come talk to me. You want to brainstorm about new ideas. You want to talk about maybe writing a proposal together or something, or just come in and chat. Like I said, I'm right on the other side of that wall. And that's it. So should I try to answer questions now, or should we just? Does anybody have a question? Yeah, press.
So you said that like, you know, one of your major pushes is obviously getting low cost systems out there. So how much of that do you think is the research that's going into it versus like the developments of industry bringing the prices down on like microprocessors and you know sensing technology?
Yeah, go ahead. So I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think we have to be aware of what's happening in industry, and we have to do research to exploit those things. So, you know, accelerometers didn't get cheap because people wanted to use them for robots. They got cheap because of airbags. And, you know, recognizing that, bringing that into your own application, I think is part of what research is. Anybody else?
Question,
yes?
In the case of the sensor networks, and you said that they were doing this like range-based SLAM there.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's true.
And normally, for example, if you want to measure temperature, humidity, you want to get very good coverage of whatever you're trying to cover.
So we, you know, in our deployment at Lancaster Farms, we didn't place the things very carefully at all. You know, they have these big flats full of plants, and the guy said, I want to measure a couple plants over here and a couple plants over there. And we went around and found places where maybe there was conveniently a pole sticking out of the ground so we could tie it to it. And when you're deploying 100 nodes over a 10-acre area, you don't really spend a lot of time getting it carefully in place.
But there are a lot of people who spend a lot of research trying to see how you can cover that land with 30 centers instead of 100.
Sure. So that's one direction to go.
I'm just curious if there was a true need for land there or not.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the application. I can dream up applications where there's a need for SLAM, but even if you don't use SLAM, then, you know, the difference between SLAM and localization once you have your map is, I mean, to me, they're the same problem. Right? They're both an estimation problem where you're taking in information as it comes along and spitting out an estimate of where you are. Oh. Anybody else? All right, then. So now I have the pleasure of introducing Marcel Bergerman to you. Marcel, like myself, was recently hired as a system scientist here at the Robotics Institute. I have to admit, I don't know much about his history, so I'm going to have to read off of his bio here. You got your PhD here, right?
Yeah, just get every third line.
Every third line. Yeah. Tele-supervised, prior, genius, institutional relationship. So he got his PhD here in 1996. He went back to Brazil to work on an airship project that was financed by the Brazilian government. And then he came back here to join RI again. In June 2005, he came back to work on the NASA-funded wide area prospecting using supervised autonomous robots project. And then he's moved down into the helicopter lab where he works with Amit and everyone down there doing great stuff. He has really interesting ideas about how to control helicopters using different feedback linearization techniques and things like that. I give you Marcel Bergerman.
Thanks a lot, sir. Thank you all. I want to make sure you guys can hear me in the back. Yeah, okay, I don't have a very strong voice, so if at some point my voice comes down, please let me know. Welcome, everybody. Some of you may be wondering why the strange title. Not all of you were born yet when the control kids, the new kids on the block were playing in the 80s, and now it's the new control kids on the block. You will remember me, well, hopefully this is the last time in my life I'm presenting myself as a new faculty at the Robotics Institute. So I have to give you guys some way of remembering me for a long time. I'm the first person in the whole city who wears a knit cap when the new cold season starts. I was the only guy wearing this morning. Nobody else wears a knit cap for another 3 weeks. So if you see someone is this, it's me. I also used to work for the royalty in England in the past before I became a roboticist. I used to be a stand-in for this colleague of mine here. And in fact, my wife's nickname in college was Princess Diana. It's just that she is Japanese, so you can see the thing there. Well, I'm here today to hopefully give you guys, I'm calling them two lessons. Maybe that's that's not too humble. Let me try to call them two beliefs. I want to pass to you two beliefs that I have that I want to share with you that I hope I can bring to the Robotics Institute that I strongly believe to be important to our lives. The first of these two beliefs is, what's my global picture? What's my global picture as a professional? And that is what I call the virtual cycle of research and innovation. I once saw in a talk this figure by a vice president of Siemens. He was talking about research and innovation, and he said, research is the activity that takes money or resources and creates knowledge. And innovation is the activity that takes knowledge and creates wealth. It seems simple and it seems obvious, but dominating or being able to complete and fulfill this cycle, both of these legs, is what differentiates developed countries from developing or underdeveloped countries. Brazil in particular is a country that's relatively strong in this lag for its size, for its population, for its GDP, but it's very poor here. The United States, of course, is very strong in this both of these lags. And this is the first of my strong beliefs. This is my global picture. If you ever want to come down to the helicopter lab and discuss innovation in general, that's a topic that I'm very pleased to discuss. I think it's important. I think this is the reason why nations grow. Some nations grow and some nations don't. A little more down to earth, because the previous slide hardly can fill my kid's stomach, right? It's kind of hard to find a job that pays me to go around talking about the virtual cycle of research and innovation. So in the practical side, on my real life, I'm a controls engineer. So probably the first question in some of your minds is, but he's not 60. Or put it in another way, have another problem been solved already? I mean, we have PID control, right? It's been working, right? Do we really need this? So my answer is no. And honestly, I see the hiring of two controls people by the Robotics Institute as a very important message. That, in fact, like George was showing by many of his examples, the continuous improvement in sensing and computing and actuation, of course, continuously allow the control engineers to pursue new projects, new ideas, many more complex things that could be done in the past, or even to revisit old ones. And therefore, control systems is still a fundamental pillar in robotics. So the second lesson or belief of the day is that the study of control systems is by far the most fascinating thing you ever see. To me, at least. Try to be humble here, but it is, right? Okay, you see, you have two people here saying that. Ralph, your opinion? Okay, you see? It's an unbiased sample. What can I say? Talk a little bit about my personal modus operandi or philosophical aspect that permeates my life as a controls engineer. I'm interested in modeling problems. I'm interested not at looking at the black, what people usually call the black box modeling. Let me look at the inputs and outputs. Let's create some model using some mathematical technique that describes what the outputs do given some inputs here. And let's wrap this up as a black box and use that to try to control the system. I'm interested in looking at the physics, the math, doing simulations, observations, understanding exactly what's in the black box. In helicopter control, for example, these are just the beginning books to understand how helicopters work. I've been there through them more than once. I still don't understand everything. But that's where the fun is, when we start to separate the knowns from the unknowns and then design and build a model-based solution. Use the math that, all the math that comes from the physics of the problem to create or to design and build solutions that are based on that model. Of course, test them and make sure that the things that you don't know don't kill you. It don't kill the project. In the case of the helicopter, don't kill us. Refine so that more and more we bring the unknowns to the known side, and new unknowns are uncovered as we go. And then, of course, you iterate until no more money, no more time, or something like that. So is this fun? I mean, I'm saying here that control systems is fascinating, and I want to do model-based control. I think it's a lot of fun, because modeling is not easy. real systems are multi-input, multi-output. They have coupling between different axes. They are nonlinear, minimum phase. There are a lot of pretty words here that could be intimidating at some point that make modeling difficult. And again, that's where the fun is. And then controlling is not easy either. When we talk about implementation issues, actuator and sensor bandwidth and saturation, there are a lot of aspects involved in modeling systems and controlling systems that make this area fascinating, not to mention system design. I mean, these things are not easy even when a system is given. Now, only when application is given and you need to design the system itself, it becomes even more fun. I'd like to share with you some examples of projects I worked on in the past. The first one is this problem of underactuated manipulators. So these are manipulators that have more joints, I'm sorry, more actuators than joints. So in this three-link arm here, there is an actuator at the first joint, but the second and third, they only have brakes, which can lock the joint on or off. There is not an actuator that can actually actuate the joint directly. And we want to go from that straight position to this final position here. And basically, the solution is to use this joint to control the positions of the other joints using the dynamic coupling in the machine. So we have more joints than actuators. This is nonlinear, non-holonomic. How we make the end effector go to a certain pose, and we don't want to hit anything on the way. So basically, we solve this problem, like I said before, by modeling the system, quantifying the dynamic coupling between the joints that are actuated and the joints that are not actuated, and then designing motion planning and controls that did the job. So one example was this 2-degree of freedom manipulator that needed to go from this initial position to this final position with two obstacles here and here. In Cartesian space, it looks like this. In joint space, these two shaded gray areas here represent the obstacles. And again, by studying the model, by looking at the non-holonomic characteristics of the manipulator, we were able to find surfaces, these S-shaped surfaces and these horizontal surfaces in the joint space. And if we follow them, we would respect the constraints and be able to navigate around the obstacles. And physically, what it means is that we start in this position, we want to end in this position. And we have to go through these intermediate configurations to achieve the goal. Robotic airships is a project that I worked on while in Brazil. We essentially had this 30-foot blimp. It's also a very interesting problem from the point of view of modeling and control. Bless you. So essentially, we were interested in using this robotic airship for environmental monitoring application, especially monitoring of, let me see if I don't get this wrong, flora and fauna. Okay, thanks. Because in Portuguese it's the other way around, so I have to think about it. It was within the context of this project that my, at that time, boss and now friend, Alberto Elfis, whom many of you know, created the now famous Kalman filter. And this project had a lot of modeling. I think it was the best part of the project to me, at least. We were extremely lucky at the time. We found like three people in the whole world who had done their PhDs in modeling airships, modeling blimps. One was dead, the other, nobody knew where the guy was, and the third one was a Brazilian who got his PhD in England and was working for the Federal Bank in Brazil. Okay, so the guy did all this huge, amazing work in blimps. He tried to push the use of blimps for transporting stuff in Brazil because it's a big country like the US. In the 80s, the government didn't want to hear about these guys, so he took one of these admission tests for the federal bank, and he became a civil servant, and he was happy. And we went to Rio de Janeiro, we found the guy, and we said, hey, we bought a blimp, and we need some help. And he was very enthusiastic, as you can imagine, and he helped us first understand his PhD thesis, refine the model, go through new wind tunnel tests at the University of Campinas, and scale his results to our airship. There were different vehicles with different vectorization, with different control surfaces. He worked with plus-shaped control surfaces. We had X-shaped. The sizes were different and things like that. So we went through all this work. It took us a good 2.5 years. But that allowed us to come up with a model that included all the dynamic, aerodynamic, gravitational, and propulsion forces that allowed us to test not model-based control loss, just simple PI, PID control loss, but at least realistically. We knew that the results we were getting in simulation were realistic and could be reproduced in the field. And in fact, in 2000, we achieved what, to the best of our knowledge, was at the time the first autonomous flight of a robotic airship, pretty much along a square. You can see several turns around the square where height was controlled manually by the pilot on the ground, and the XY coordinates were controlled by the onboard computer. And now I'm working with robotic helicopters. So that you can see a pattern here of working on modeling and control of aerial vehicles, which I really find fascinating.
Just stop as if your life depends upon it.
I'm not sure if everybody heard what Omid was saying here on the tape, but he's telling our pilot, just stop as if your life depends on it. So this is a human pilot doing what's considered a difficult maneuver with this kind of helicopter. So we work at the helicopter lab with the Yamaha R-Max, a 10-foot unmanned helicopter sold in Japan for crop dusting and retrofitted here to be an autonomous aircraft. Most of you have heard of Omid. Omid's been working on this for 17 years, and I have had the pleasure of being part of that lab for the past year and a half. So robotic helicopters are very interesting because when you compare them with the airship, they are very fast and highly maneuverable. The airship is very slow and not very low, very little maneuverable. Both can take off and land vertically. Both are capable of hovering. The airship, of course, has a better payload to weight ratio compared to the helicopter, especially when you consider the fact that it's this huge balloon of helium, right, that's just pushing up. So the actual weight of the whole thing in flight is like 1 pound, right? In fact, we would trim the quantity of helium and equipment on board to make the whole thing weigh exactly 4 pounds. And it's also interesting to think of how these two machines behave in case of an accident. If something goes wrong with an airship, many people still have the picture of the Hindenburg, right, in their minds. But today we are using helium, which is inert, and the whole thing essentially weighs 4 pounds. So if the engine stops and this thing comes down, it hits you. Essentially, you don't die. You may get a headache. If the helicopter dies, if the engine goes down on the helicopter, it's a whole different ballgame. Now, nice machines, however, they have many of those nasty big words that I mentioned in the beginning when I said that modeling was not easy. Now you may ask, okay, but Omid has been flying this thing for 10 years, right? Yes, and he developed a non-model-based controller which has to be tuned every time. Every time we go flying, we have to, you know, feel the wind, and the pilot does some adjustments and plays with the trim, and then we play with the gains, and then we get the right gains for that particular situation. It works really well for the purposes of deploying lasers and cameras on board the helicopter, which is this lab's main focus for the past 10 years. But from my point of view of increasing the capabilities of robotic helicopters, it's not enough. So the first thing I started doing when I joined the lab was model the system, again, going through nice little books like the ones I showed. Started also looking at the literature. I was lucky to find a linear system that describes the Yamaha RMX in hover, done by some guys at NASA Ames. Luckily, we found in simulation, not in flight, that their model had two minus signals inverted somewhere. And that could have been a big problem in the field. And this is a story I'd like to share. We built this 3D graphical simulator that runs the dynamic model in the background to give kind of a realistic feel of the helicopter in flight. And we asked our pilot, Todd, to fly the simulation, like just like a flight simulator, and tell us if it felt right. And he flies it for a while, and he says, you know, Marcel, feels mostly right, but it turns funny. I said, OK, it turns funny. So took me another month or so to find why it turns funny. It turns funny because there are two minus signals in the off-diagonal elements of the A matrix that describes this linear system that were inverted. And I don't know if there's something different in the helicopter that the NASA guys use. Maybe there's something different. But we're lucky to find that. We're lucky to have Todd as our pilot who could help with that. And then we went through a design process combining a feedback linearization loop and a linear quadratic regulator loop to achieve this kind of performance. So in blue, you see the actual trajectory. In red, you see the reference trajectory. So this was the model-based controller that we developed and flew first battery of flights. By that, I want to say we took a linear model from the literature. We made sure it represented our system well in simulation. Ran a design process using known techniques which have been around for 30 years. Coded that in C, went to the field, turned it on, and it works like this. So it gave me great confidence in that it is possible to model a robotic helicopter to a great extent using very deep understanding of the physics that goes on these machines to develop controllers for them. Just to give you an idea of the performance of the PD controller, it's a little better. I'm not going to say that this one is better. This is definitely better. You can clearly see in these pictures. But then again, this has been around for 10 years. There's a lot of hand tuning. I want to work on making this kind of controller have the best performance possible and no more hand tuning. So what I want to work on in the next 3 to 5 years is in enhancing navigation, guidance, and control for autonomous helicopters in particular, and perhaps aero vehicles in general. And by that, I mean work on modeling, estimation, planning, obstacle avoidance, sensing, and model-based control. So again, you see there's a lot of overlap between the buzzwords I'm using here and George. And I want to bring again my belief that control systems look, if you look at the control systems area at large, when you include sensing, estimation, actuation, is a very important area in robotics. It's an area or a set of technologies and theories that will continue to be important and improve the performance of robotic systems for many decades. So just to make sure you don't forget, if you don't have research and innovation together, you cannot develop a country. Sorry, that's my belief. And you want looking for, you're looking for something to study, control systems. That's the thing. I didn't do this all by myself, of course. A lot of people helped me get here, either working for me or bossing me or collaborating with me, whatever term you want to use. But I am very indebted to the people that I show here and many others. Thank you so much. I guess I'll take questions. I guess I was very clear. Yeah.
Can we have a combination of helicopters and airships in the same system?
There, I've seen attempts in the literature of people trying to combine both things. In fact, Greg has some concept in his how do I call it, his magic vault. What would be a good name? Okay. if you want to learn about concepts like this, Greg is a great source of ideas like this. There were concepts in the past, and there are still some concepts like this floating around, where you try to combine the fact that the blimp gives you the buoyancy with the maneuverability of the helicopter. Yes, Sanjay.
I'm wondering if you're thinking about tasks that cannot be done, as opposed to things that are done more accurately or with higher fidelity without this kind of modeling. So, for example, one thing I'm interested in is fixed-wing aircraft flying like hovercraft. Okay. So fixed-wing aircraft, if you do some cool modeling, can come down and almost come to a zero flight. One of the big problems with fixed-wing aircraft is that you're forced to fly at some minimum speed.
Right.
Unless you do some crazy stuff, and then you can bring the speed down to something very, very low, which could be very useful.
Okay.
Or rotorcraft doing things that are sort of impossible to think about, you know, flying in ways inverted or making this. Andrew Ng, of course, made his whole career based on showing this great picture of this inverted thing.
Right.
But I think the going back and forth between these kinds of things is not so common. The transition between forward, upright flight and inverted flight is not so common. Are you thinking about problems like that, where sort of like the dynamics are sort of the key to sort of taking a problem, making some capability that is absolutely not possible before, now possible?
I confess I don't think I ever thought in those terms, Sanjeev. I come, like I said in my job talk, I come from a school where I look at the model first and see what kinds of applications, what kinds of capabilities we can achieve with that model, and what kinds of applications we cannot, because the model is limited. And then refine the model to go to the next step. I'll have to think more about what is that's not possible today. And I'd love to hear from you if you want to let me know that the current models cannot do, and investigate how we get there. I have, again, this belief, and maybe because I'm naive, because I'm not 60 maybe, but I have this belief that if it's a machine that we built, that a human being built, and it's interacting with the world not very complicated way, I think we can model it. Modeling the weather is very harsh. there are some models that are very complicated. Modeling human societies are complicated because we didn't build them. But I have this belief, again, that if we build it, then we can model it. And if we can model it, we can pretty much do anything. But I could just be naive. But I think it could be done. Yes, please.
So I was kind of wondering, when you said that you weren't so interested in black box systems, that you wanted well-defined models. But, I mean, surely you can acknowledge that there's going to be a little bit of error in the parameters that you
use. In the error, yes. In the model, yes.
So have you looked at kind of ways that the two come together, where you start with what you think is the best model, but it kind of shifts a little bit in the parameters towards what's more realistic?
There are well-established techniques to do that.
Right.
And that's where I want to go. I want to work on models, start developing models that are simpler and see how far they can go, and then making them more and more complex. There are tools like sensitivity analysis. Okay, I know that I don't know this parameter very well, or I know this parameter within certain bounds. If the parameter were perfectly known, this is the behavior I get. Now it's between these bounds. This is the error I get amplified here at the end. If I can do this sensitivity analysis, I kind of can figure out on this side what kind of performance I can get. So I still would rely on modeling techniques even in that case. Thank you. Yes, Chris.
So the helicopter autopilots exist?
I'm sorry?
The helicopter autopilots for full-size helicopters, do they exist?
I confess I don't know. I confess it's something I never looked for.
Yes.
They do? Okay. Thank you. For airplanes, of course.
Yes.
For sure. And I once flew from São Paulo to Manaus when I was working in the Amazon, and on the pilot's cabin. In Brazil, it's a little less strict, the security issue. So I flew in the pilot's cabin. And I got to see the autopilot in action, especially the approach, lining up with the landing strip. I found it amazing. Amazing. But you said there are for helicopters. If I had to guess an answer, I would say yes. But I confess I wouldn't know a specific example. Would you know a specific example?
There is a system, anything from single-axis helping to full.
Okay. I would guess so, I mean, if there is for airplanes, yeah.
But the good news for you, Marcel, is you still have a job, because I think the scale of the autopilots for the helicopters, the scale matters a lot, so when you have a big helicopter autopilot works well, but you're not scaled down to a small.
Especially because the sensors that you need to use are have to be a lot smaller and cheaper, and the computing that you have on board, that makes a difference. That's one aspect, of course.
But I don't know, the interaction between the error, the mechanism, the weight of the mechanism, with all that would also not scale down.
It definitely scales differently for each of the things in the model, because some properties of the aerodynamics model scale down with the dimension, some with the square of the dimension, some with the cube of the dimension. And that's, in fact, part of what I'm studying now. How do we model the helicopter from a first principles physical or physics point of view instead of a linear model such as the one that I've been using so far? So that's something I'm still learning about. Well, I guess, thank you very much. Hope you didn't mind.